is KRFY 88.5 Ponderay.
This is 88.5 KRFY, community-supported public radio for North Idaho.
Good morning, it's the Community Character Hour, and I'm here with Hannah Combs. We usually start this program with a reading from the newspapers of the past here in North Idaho. What have you got for us today, Hannah?
Today's clipping comes from the Ponderay Review from July 24th, 1930. It says, "The annual field day at the Sandpoint Experiment Station will be combined with the Bonner County Guernsey Association picnic Sunday at the Experiment Farm," stated J.H. Christ, superintendent, today. "An invitation is extended to everyone interested to attend the picnic Sunday and make an inspection of the station. This will be the only opportunity to make a thorough examination of the work being done during this year," stated Mr. Christ today. "Talks and demonstrations are included on the program Sunday, in addition to a trip through the station."
An experiment station.
Indeed. So this is something that I'm hoping we can do a whole episode about in the future. But the experiment station was the origins of the old U of I experimental farm that some of you may remember on North Boyer heading out of town. And at the time, that property and the property just south of it, where Pisney is, were all part of the experiment station, which was the first iteration of this kind of experimental farm. So the building that used to be the cottage, the thrift store that Pisney runs, was the experiment station's superintendent's home. And all of the land north of there was this experimental farm. And they were trying to figure out all kinds of different crops and agricultural products and testing out how they could grow in North Idaho. So they were bringing in things from all over the country. They were playing around with native plants and just generally trying to figure out how to make this area better support agriculture.
This is a... This was run by the university, or
it wasn't, and that's part of the mystery that we'll have to figure out for an episode down the road. Is learning a little bit more about exactly who was running the experiment station. Side note, but there was also, and it still exists, a very cool experimental forest over north of Priest River, which still operates to this day, and they are always doing much longer term experiments on different trees and figuring out all kinds of things about forest health over there. But it's a beautiful area, and they have all these cool old cabins from the, I'm guessing, the 1930s over there.
Is this public property? Can I go over there and take a look?
You can drive through it on the way to public property. I don't want to say too much, but I know I've driven up there to access trails up on Mount, I think that's Mount Gisborne over there.
Wow. Well, and how is this relevant to what we're talking about today? Hannah, what made you decide on this?
Well, when we were last, when we were discussing last month's topic, which was the Ice Age floods, I think we were trying to figure out what our transition would be from that cataclysmic event into the people who came to live in this area. And something that we realized would have to kind of repopulate the area before it could sustain human life would be plants. And so
And so we sought out an expert on the subject. We decided to talk to would we call him a natural historian, I guess?
Absolutely.
One of the foremost natural historians in our area, Jack Nesbitt. And we recorded a conversation with him last week, which we'll be playing for you in just a minute. How did you come across Jack Nesbitt? When did you first encounter him? You kind of set up our conversation with him.
Yeah. So working at the museum, and just in the history field in this area, Jack is pretty much a legend, and just a fount of knowledge. If you're looking for truly expert level knowledge of this area, settler period, so early history of North Idaho, Eastern Washington, the whole Columbia River region, Jack has written many books on different topics of natural history, naturalists who've explored this area, David Thompson, and his map-making explorations. So he's kind of the go-to guy for that period of time, and it was a real treat to get to speak with him.
It was indeed. You know, we went down with a list of questions and pretty much threw them out right as soon as we started talking. So what you're going to hear, rather than go through and edit this hour-long conversation into, you know, sound chunks and question and answer, it was a fascinating conversation just to be a part of. When I say he did most of the talking, and we just kind of let him tell us the story. And as you'll hear me say kind of at the end, that it wasn't exactly what I had pictured, but it's valuable anyway. Hopefully it's valuable to you, the listener. Hopefully you enjoy it as much as we did.
Mm-hmm. And I think like many great conversations and explorations of history, through this process, we learned how to ask different questions than mm-hmm. we first anticipated.
Yeah, I think, yes, I think we went in with logical questions, but I don't think they were, I think we learned that they were not the right questions to be asking. At least I mm-hmm. did. The questions I wanted answered were not applicable, I think, would be the way to say that. Anything else you want to say before I turn on the recording here, Hannah?
Let's jump into it.
Okay, here we go. The next voice you hear will be, it'll be me, and then and then we'll be talking to Jack Nesbitt, recorded just last week. We're sitting here in the Spokane Public Library, and Hannah and I are now joined by Jack Nesbitt to talk a little bit about the plant life in North Idaho, and especially the plant life that was naturally occurring just after the Ice Age floods that had wiped our area clean and reshaped it to more or less the landscape that we recognize today. Jack, would you introduce yourself a little bit? Tell us about yourself and kind of your area of historical expertise.
So I'm a writer and a naturalist. I grew up in the South. My mother and grandmother taught me some natural history. They were into birds and plants. And I came out to Northeast Washington in 1970 and started writing a little column, like a what flower is this, what plant, what bird is that column for the Chihuahua Independent, which is a little weekly paper. And that proved to be an excuse to talk to anybody with knowledge. So I rode around a lot with Forest Service and Game Department and BLM people. And then they introduced me to tribal people by chance. And then that became clear that was the track to take, because there was some women. There was a family still living in the Colville Valley that remembered the river, remembered what it looked like before the river was dredged in 1912. So you can take certain dates like the Ice Age floods or the moment of contact, but if you're thinking about how the place looked, and you go to a small valley like the Hoodoo Valley south of Sandpoint, and when they dredged the river, that changed everything and made it so you could do agriculture there. Before that, it was often wetlands left over from the flood, from the Ice Age floods. So I spent a time figuring that out and realized that David Thompson was the first guy to write about it all, and that David Douglas was the first person who was here specifically. He was the first non-fur trade guy on the scene. Every other white guy. So David Thompson's here from 1870 to 1812. David Douglas comes 15 years later. Thompson's long gone, but all of his guys stayed here and married tribal women. So David Douglas comes into this mixed blood world where there's cultural memory. He's following, it's a maternal kind of a annual round that they're making. So you go up in the mountains and pick berries and you go dig roots in the spring kind of stuff. And they're part of that. And Douglas gets guided around by Thompson's two main honchos, Jocko Finley and Finney McDonald, and meets several other ones, meets their wives, takes their kids around, does all kinds of stuff. But that was, so for the past 40 years, really, I've just been trying to figure that out. And you can go to any reservation and see the names on Thompson's pay list, mm-hmm. and then you're right into it. And you can go to any of the towns like Sandpoint or Chewila and see the names on Thompson's pay list. And so they might be living white, the others might be living tribal. But nothing, it's culture that matters, not race or bloodlines or anything, really. It's, are you interested in plants? Do you want to explore them as a world? And I got to know people on both sides that were interested in natural history. So it's really an easy thing for me to do, as long as I'm not in any hurry to do anything, as long as I'm willing to go back and back every year and see the changes and all that. So the time becomes the crucial thing, as it is for any writer. And to say that, well, the floods, they keep changing the date, of course. The floods are 14 or 13,000 years ago or whatever. I mean, people were certainly here during the floods. That's pretty much proven by oral histories of tribes all over the Columbia Basin. And there's archaeology from Seine-Aquitaine from 12,000 years ago. So, I mean, and it got washed away by the floods, and then people were right there. So to say that it's a clean slate isn't exactly right. I mean, they're just living above where the floods were, which is, you know, it's another few hundred feet of elevation. Plenty of people live in that zone right now. Mm-hmm. So to watch the world come back in this big gravel dump that is the Hoodoo, say, 300 feet of gravel, most, you know, Spokane. The river's rerouted, and it's the falls are now here, and the old trail is now, you know, a river. It's just, it's great fun, but Thompson is led around by the tribes in various circles that they direct him in that are all Ice Age flood trails, that all are their trails, and then how they adjusted to the floods, and then how it's practical to get to the places they were trying to go. Thompson's trying to go to the Pacific and do his colonial imperial thing. That's not really what the agenda is here. So, again, I'm trying to do it one plant at a time, and that turns out to be perfectly possible because of the way that it's set up. We're still very isolated, which is a huge advantage that the tribes had, where Thompson comes, and instead of the world ending, it's 50 more years before the before it's the United States even. And then after that, there's a bunch of wars and fear and displacement before it starts settling down in the 1880s and 90s. So again, you can make these markers out, like contact or when the first surveys were done. Or I prefer to use a man who lived on Lake Pend'Oreille, John Lieberg, who in 1893 did the first real formal survey of the Columbia Basin, and then followed it up with the first forest surveys on land that was going to be the national forest that we're all surrounded by. Mm-hmm. And he was up on a very high level. So Thompson is interested in plants, and he's eating all the time, so food is important. Mm-hmm. Douglas is really interested in the plants for gardens, mm-hmm. but then he got into the tribal world through these contacts and mixed blood families. He's really interested. Lieberg was not trained. He was a Swedish immigrant who had no training, but he was very sharp. You know, he wanted to be a miner, just like everybody else that ever showed up in Pend'Oreille County. in Ponderay world, but he didn't make any money, just like almost everybody else that showed up there. And his way of making a living was doing these forest surveys for first the U.S. Department of Agriculture and then the USGS. So they were his paychecks were coming from the government at the end of every summer. He was a seasonal worker. And so Thompson's maps and journals are a real primary source. It's really important to answer this simple question that you're asking. Mm-hmm. Douglas's plant specimens, by 1,200 of them at Kew alone, are the next level of primary document. And every little label that he wrote becomes this primary document that you can get some ideas from. And then Lieberg, coming 70 years after Douglas, almost 70 years, is the next one. And then the river dredging would be the next one, and the utter change that agriculture brings. Lieberg sees it at the very beginnings of agriculture. He's surveying Priest River when they've taken some logs out for railroad ties. They haven't developed any mines yet, but it's just he gets to see what we think we want to see. But what you learn is, and what he finally learned is, it's still a managed landscape. The tribes are managing, especially in the Ponderosa areas, but with fire, have been since the flood. And so there's he and Thompson both say the most beautiful part of this world is these big Ponderosa pines around Spokane or around Kootenai Falls in certain parts of North Idaho. It's, you know, there's such a steep gradient for moisture when you're at Sandpoint, and you can get dry very fast and you can get wet very fast. And that's what they're trying to live outside, so they're very sensitive to that. So they want open pines that they can ride their horse through. That's what they want, with bunch grass underneath that the horses can eat, knots of berries that you can use for your riding. That's a managed landscape that the tribes worked very hard to maintain.
So I associate that kind of landscape more with this area around Spokane.
That is true, but if you go, you don't have to go very far south of Sandpoint to see it. If you go east of Sandpoint and you're at Kootenai Falls, you're in it again.
Okay.
But if you go up just a few hundred feet, then you're in the inland wet belt, what is now we now call the interior rainforest. That's a marvel worldwide now, as more people recognize it. So Thompson is trying to understand that with limited knowledge, right? Like, he's coming from England with three types of conifers that he grew up with, but very into natural history. Comes here and there's 12 types of conifers, and he's got to build everything he makes, from his bowl for breakfast to his cabin that they're living in to the trade house. It's a steep learning curve to decide whether to go larch or Douglas fir or white fir, or what are these white pines, or what are these tribes. The tribes teach him all that. So very quickly, and he's been in the business for 25 years when he gets here, and he has a tribal wife. So right away, he's just saying, tell me, please, what I need for this. He makes a few mistakes, and they bite him. So he goes back and says, you know, I was wrong about that. Tell me what I should be doing. And they have a lot of agency and can steer him around like they want, which is, again, against the traditional line of history that we take. And the plants are kind of like that to me, that it's unexpected. We think a Sandpoint is a wet place, but you don't have to go far to see, like at Priest, which we think of as a really wet place. Well, right after the floods, there's this altothermal period that's really hot and dry, and there's sagebrush at Priest. And that's pollen will show you that. But there's people there too. So they get to watch it change as they live, which we're all freaking out because the world is going to change once. They change 12,000 years where it's a cycle like that and survive it, these Salish-speaking people. So again, that's a humility lesson for us and a patience lesson for us. But again, archaeology shows that if you go to Priest and stand at where the museum is on the west side, they can look across at the islands and look across at the peninsula there. There's archaeology that has caches of equipment there and burns that clearly show tribal people running game with burns and then running them out into the lake and killing them, that kind of thing. So when John Lieberg is homesteading on the south end of Lake Ponderay in the late 1880s, which seems recent compared to all this, right? He's writing letters back to his people at New York Botanic Garden and in D.C. going, man, my neighbors, I don't know what I'm going to do about them. They, like, are driving deer down into the lake and killing them from their canoes. It just seems barbaric to me, and I'm trying to get them to stop. Uh-huh. And you go, wait a minute. You mean Kalispell villages are still there doing that stuff that they've been doing for thousands of years? And the answer is yes. Where they were left alone, where they weren't run out, where in places they were isolated, they never stopped doing what they were doing. So to think of it, you can think of it as these markers where everything's changing, but if you're a plant and you look at Douglas's list, and that's how I do my research, is I try to get the journal of Lieberg or Douglas or Thompson and go to the same place they were on the same day of the year. Doesn't seem like brain rocket science to me. And to the plants are amazingly resilient. I mean, there's weeds, there's introduced things around that I don't really know whether to call weeds or not. There's lots of new things that have come, but they're looking at a lot of new things. And they introduced a lot of our plants back to Europe that become weeds there. It's the plants controlling us is an easy way to look at it. So if you're in Europe now and you're complaining about a plant that's native to Priest Lake being a weed in your backyard, making it hard to get around. I mean, that's not really on the plant, I don't think. That's how imperialism works and how the Brits set it up, right? I mean, they're trying to make money off David Thompson, not making that much. They're trying to make money off Douglas and making bank on white pine as an ornamental, white, these fir trees that grow here, and the Engelmann spruce and stuff, those are immediately become ornamental trees in rich people's arboretums up in northern Scotland that are British nobility, that have poor Scottish people working on them. That's how Douglas came up. He was a kid in a poor Scottish village working for a manor that was run by him. So again, you can't talk about any one of these things without pulling into economics, political stuff, social stuff. That's why I like to start with plants. And again, if you can go with one plant, I might not ramble on for so long. but that's how I'm trying to work my way through theoretically writing a biography of David Douglas. I mean, he gets born in the beginning and he dies at the end, but really I'm trying to write about this place and what happens is the plants. I mean, I'm writing the same question you're asking.
And he was really kind of carrying on this centuries old legacy at that point of this kind of exploration and plant collecting, right?
Not centuries old, but it's so Cook, Captain Cook is the world. Captain Cook is the whole world. And if you go back to his three voyages around the world that involve the Northwest, you can read these stories. So David Thompson is born in 1770, and he is a Welsh kid. His parents immigrate to London to get a job. Welsh people are trash to them. In the newspapers, they talk about them just like they talk about tribal people back east when we're out here. They're ugly, you can't educate them, well, they're going to go extinct, and their language is going to go extinct, etc. And his dad dies right after he gets there, so he has zero prospects. We know nothing about his mother, or how she survived or anything, but he's in a tough part of London. So there are these trade schools. For reasons we do not understand, somebody sponsors him at this trade school that's going to teach carpentry, and he's there in 1776. That's the year that Captain Cook besides the American Revolution started, Captain Cook, through a misunderstanding and his being arrogant, gets his head beat in by the Hawaiians. And Thompson's school is right on the Thames. And I mean, when the word gets back, London is in mourning. We have no heroes as big as Cook was at that time. Cook is his guy.
Yeah.
Is his guy. So Thompson gets out in 17. From then on, all he wants to do is join the Navy and sail the world like Cook did. And Cook was the same way. So again, you get into that. But they talk about Cook and his stuff all the time. So does Douglas. The guy who did the plants on Cook's, worked up the plants that Cook's aristocratic collector got, is a man named Jupiter Brown, who was like Douglas, a poor Scottish kid who got really good at plants. He's the one who worked them up. Douglas knew Jupiter Brown. the guy who sailed with George Vancouver that did the first real survey of the Northwest, and, but only stayed on the coast, was a Scottish guy named Archibald Menges. Mm-hmm. Douglas knew him, and they interviewed them both before he came here so he'd get an idea of what it was going to be like. They only knew the coast. Mm-hmm. So he gets to the coast, and it's claustrophobic, it's rainforest. He just is not enjoying it in a lot of ways.
He
would
have sailed all the way around.
Nine months. Seattle, yeah, he comes to the mouth of the Columbia to tell the story. Mm-hmm. So he leaves England, goes all the way around. It takes 9 months. The whole world changes while you're gone. He's out of his mind on the ocean with all that stuff. But when he gets here, he has a really good idea of what's being here. He's already been back east and looked at all of Lewis and Clark's collection. In other words, it's not a closed system we're here. The communication is really strong. And again, he meets Finn and McDonald and some of Thompson's other guys who have tribal wives but are down at Fort Vancouver delivering their furs. He says, yeah, I'm just here collecting and I'm going to go back, in the spring. And they go, Oh no, you can't go back. You got to come see the Wallowas. You got to come see the Okanagan. You got to come see the Flathead country. I mean, you can't go back. Mm-hmm. So he doesn't go back. He writes a letter saying, I can't come back. And I'll somehow go home. He ends up going back overland to Hudson's Bay with the fur trade.
Really?
The canoes.
Okay.
So again, it seems impossible the way we think, but they have the fur trade. Owns this place. Again, it's another imperialist thing that they've owned it since 1680.
Okay.
They've owned our part of North America since 1680. And they're sure that they're going to keep owning it.
Yeah.
And Thompson's sure that his surveys and maps will allow them to keep owning it. Mm-hmm. And that Lewis and Clark are great. He's well aware of them. Everything south of the Columbia will belong to Thomas Jefferson and his vision. Everything north will be the crown. So he's outraged when they give it away.
Mm.
But by then the United States had the power, right?
Was it a trade or was it a...
No, it was power.
Power.
It was the United States going, yeah, well... Mm-hmm. That might be what you think. But in 1770, they didn't have that kind of power. And when Thompson came in 1810, they didn't have that kind of power. I mean, in the War of 1812, the Americans are getting kicked around by the British Navy. British Navy is the most powerful force in the world. When Douglas comes, it's starting to wane. And by after a while, in the 1840s, when they finally sign the treaty, it's the Americans that are on the ascension power-wise. So I try to ignore all that. Like, that's the way most of the books are written, right?
Yeah.
And all this stuff has been written about before, but as a writer, I'm going, well, yeah, people have seen that, but nobody's incorporated the fur trade into that story and beaver and otter into that story. Mm-hmm. Nobody's incorporated tribal families into that story.
Mm-hmm.
And nobody's incorporated individual plants into that that might be something that will feed you and that kind of thing. So that's my attempt on that. And if I keep coming back to, if I get too carried away, if this soundbite is longer than you want on your thing, I can come back and we can say, okay, let's talk about Bitterroot.
So I was going to ask if you could tell the history, the early history of this land through the story of one plant, what plant would you choose?
That would be biscuit roots for sure.
Biscuit roots?
For sure. And... it's too botanical maybe to get to. Another maybe a better way to do it first is to think about these wet and dry cycles and think about Priest or Ponderay having sagebrush around it and then coming to maybe some pines and then coming to the Douglas fir and then coming to the white pine that's so famous that is what Thompson described and Lieberg described. And then it's cycling away from that in our world.
Mm-hmm.
So John Lieberg does his survey. He's living on Ponderay. We know all the stuff that grew around him. And he's surveying at Priest and in the Bitterroot and in the Clearwater and in the St. Joe. He's everywhere in North Idaho and Western Montana and Eastern Marshall. What became the Priest River National Forest, which is now Panhandle or Peninsula or whatever they decide to call it after this all settles out, the not national forest. 90% of the merchantable timber for him was white pine and larch.
Mm-hmm.
If you go up there now, it's Douglas fir, and it's just changed entirely in Grandford.
Mm-hmm.
And That's because of the way we managed the land and the way we managed our logging. And you can think about that when you do your logging thing and talk about the great white pine logging companies and mm-hmm. mills that, you know, created Sandpoint mm-hmm. and created us and put all the pilings in the river and all that. Right. That's it. That'll be a big thing. But when Thompson comes, it's still white pine. Mm-hmm. And the basic thing that he sees is, wow, I need to get around. I need to get around here. There's no birch bark for canoes. And yet the mm-hmm. Kalispell people are making these killer canoes out of white pine, one piece of white pine bark. And if I could just learn to do that, I could do it. And it's really hard to learn to do that. It takes generations of plant knowledge to do that. So I might choose white pine. But I might choose white pine. And then you can go, then we could go out and do a hike and see all the white pines that with blister rust that are going to die and how few there are of them. And then so maybe see one that's really good. Looking for a canoe quality white pine tree, which you can find in the Sandpoint world, you can find, but you got to look at a lot of blister rust flags, you know, those brown mm-hmm. flags that they have that are going to prevent that.
I'm going to interject really quickly just to say, if you want to see an example of one of these white pine canoes that Jack is talking about, we have a replica at the Bonner County History Museum. So you can come by during our open hours and see the type of canoe that Jack's describing.
You are listening to 88.5 KRFY. That's a recording, and we're going to go back to it in just a second. But I just wanted to pause here and reintroduce our guest. We're talking to Jack Nesbitt. This is a recording that we made last week. You're listening to the Community Character Hour here on 88.5 KRFY. I'm Jack Peterson, and I'm here with Hannah Combs, Executive Director of the Bonner County Historical Society and Museum. Are you enjoying the listen back so far, Hannah?
Almost as much as hearing it in person the first time.
Yeah. I notice this on the second listen through how much he uses the present tense when he's talking about historical characters sometimes. Mm-hmm. And I mean, that's just I don't want to read too much into it, but the way he kind of tells the story is that Thompson is in a certain place rather mm-hmm. than he was 200 years ago.
Yeah. You
know? And that's,
it brings it to life.
It does. We're going to pick up with the second half of the conversation talking. The first name mentioned here is Bill Brewster. Do you want to briefly tell us who that is, how he's connected to our area?
Yeah. Your work? Yeah. So I did not realize that how Jack and Bill were connected, which you'll hear about in a moment. But I'm familiar with Bill because he is the guy who built both of the canoes that are on display at the museum, both the white pine canoe and the white pine Salish sturgeon nose canoe, and the cedar plank canoe that's a replica of one David Thompson built.
Okay. Well, then here we are, continuing with part two of our conversation with Jack Nesbitt.
And so in doing the Thompson work, I got up with Bill Brewster, who and became really great friends with him. And we understood the canoes were the whole deal. And for Thompson, I thought I was working on Thompson. And Thompson designed his own cedar plank canoe because he was in an area where he couldn't get, because white pine can only be gotten right here, you know, around Sandpoint and Priest, of the quality that they're looking mm-hmm. for, which is, they have to have something. They're trying to go from the Pacific to Hudson's Bay, right? Yeah. So you have to have some more options. And it's, again, as the more you hang around with tribal people, a common saying among them is, okay, so we know where we're going to go get our white pine or our biscuit root or our Indian hemp for cordage. We know right we're going to go get it this year because we remember how it was looking last year. And then we get there, if there's been a fire, if they dredge the river, if something happens, we always have a backup to go get something else. So the Kalispell might make their canoes out of white pine, but they know how to get it off of Engelmann spruce mm-hmm. or larch if they have to. Thompson makes a note of that in his journal. Okay. So he's a boat builder, so he's paying attention to everything. And he's been in the eastern woodlands world where it's always white birch, big paper birch, you know, that really make a canoe out of. The birch here is a different species. It doesn't work. It's a botanical anomaly. Okay. And so it's not going to work. He has people bringing white birch over the pass, carrying rolls of white birch over at the Basket Pass. The fir trade does that for a while. Because until Thompson designs this cedar plank canoe. Mm-hmm. So if you go to the museum, you can see Bill's cedar plank canoe. But why? And so that's like 40 pages of journal entries from Thompson that Bill follows out, that we transcribed and did all these, had to figure out what a sponge bar was and that kind of thing. Really fun. Uh-huh. Really fun stuff. And it took a pretty crazy person to do it, but very dogged. Well, that's David Thompson or Bill Brewster. Right? I mean, that's the level of intensity and focus that you have to have in order to make this work. Mm-hmm. It's the level of focus that the Kalispell have to make a white pine, but they've been doing it for 10,000 years, so they just do it. Mm-hmm. You can't do it. You can't just do it. You can't just pull the bark off and do it. There's so many millions of little steps involved. Mm-hmm. That's what Bill was good at. So, again, I send people to the museum all the time when they start asking these questions and just can't believe it. Like, Bill Brewster is mortified that there's a crack in his canoe at the museum that's opened up because it's dry and they need to stay wet. But he can't figure out how to do anything. You know, he's elsewhere now, both physically and mentally. So,
but that's a good example.
He would go up to the museum and steal it at night.
Yeah,
and bring it back.
No, but that's a great example of what you're saying. Is this knowledge has to be shared
correct
for it to continue?
Correct. It has to be shared. It has to. No one there's all these common aphorisms that Thompson uses and that the tribe uses. No one person knows everything. Mm-hmm. So when he's building a canoe, he is a master boat builder, but he would never build a canoe by himself. He has three or four, usually Iroquois, but also French Canadian, which is code for mixed blood, Eastern tribes. He always has those guys around because they're masters too. And when they come to a problem, which you do every 10 minutes, you've got to put your head together and get it. So it has to be shared, and then it has to be passed along. So right now, every Aboriginal tribe in the world is trying to recreate their boat, because everybody's got a boat, and their language.
Yeah.
And a lot of the language is gone, and a lot of the boats are gone. Mm-hmm. With the Kalispell, they're both still hanging in there, but it's a near thing. Mm-hmm. So they have people, you know, all these paddles that are, all these summer paddles, and the dugout canoes and all that. All that's fantastic. It's great. And off of that, the most serious people like Sean Brigman will go ahead and learn how to make bark canoes. Sean is a master boat builder who learned a lot from Bill, but also adds his own stuff into it and shares with coastal people and other people. Nobody can do it all by themselves. Everybody that gets into it gets to do it their way. Mm-hmm. Everybody gets to tell their own story the way they want to. So, you know, Bill or me or David Thompson can get all bent out of shape about how it plays out, because you never understand how it's going to play out. Mm-hmm. That's what I'm trying to get across about plants. We can never predict what this next habitat will be. We can say, okay, we're going to restore this to the way Thompson saw it. No, we aren't.
Yeah.
No, we aren't. The plants are going to control how it gets restored, and we cannot predict what they are going to do. So you can learn these lessons. You can learn them wherever you want to. From raising your kids, you can learn them. But then you have to apply them to every aspect of it as you move through the countryside. And in Kalispell world, that's Flathead Lake to the mouth of the Ponderay, down to Spokane, up to Kettle Falls, down to Missoula. It's a big world. You just happen to be in the middle of it at Sandpoint, which makes Sandpoint a very interesting place. It's a meeting place of very small differences in culture and language, like from Spokane to Flathead. But it's also a meeting place of very large things, like at Indian Meadows when Thompson gets there. There's Sampoy people there, there's Nez Perce people there, there's Okanagan people there, there's Kootenai people there, because there's these nexi of different things that happen, and they're there. The women are there to collect plants. The guys are there maybe to hunt and fish, but the women are there to collect plants. And that, and again, if you just start at Sandpoint and the lake and then work your way out, you can do it through Lieberg's plant list. Douglas didn't get here for interesting reasons, but they really wanted him to come. He really wanted to come. It's quite a loss that he didn't get to come here.
Yeah.
But it was intentional. He was at Kettle, And he has one, a man named John Work, who's going to be working over at Thompson Falls, and says, no, you got to come. You won't believe what it's like. It just gets more and more strange. And then we get into this web belt and all these things. And Work was a farmer, so he knew he was a plant guy.
Okay.
So again, you keep always coming back. Douglas has him collecting seeds for him from different plants because he knows he understands what a viable seed is. But there's a boat leaving from Fort Vancouver, which happens once a year, and they're about to leave, and he's got to get all these plants on it, or he will be nothing. He has nothing already because he doesn't have any social standing, but he's getting some attention because he's sending back these really valualable plants.
And you said he was commissioned by Kew Gardens,
Royal Horticultural Society, which is still. It was then called the London Horticultural Society, but it's all built around Kew and the RHS now. Yeah. So if you're in London and go to Kew, your mind will explode really quickly, and Douglas is a part of that.
So that's not a boss that you want to disappoint by not getting this plant.
If you're Douglas and your dad was, you grew up with your dad laying stones up at the manor house, and you, at age 10, became an apprentice up there and learned the kitchen garden where you were feeding them for supper, and the shrub garden where you could do shrubs and the berries and that, and the trees from the arboretum, that kind of thing. You didn't want to disappoint him. You wanted to put your... He's an ambitious guy. He's really insulted that they won't give him his props for knowing it, but they will never give him his props because it's a very strict class society. Mm-hmm. And it's starting to break down a little bit, but if you're Douglas, it turns out not really.
Yeah.
I mean, he was a very frustrated man, and the doorman at Royal Horticultural Society was making more money than he did to be over here working 24/7 and almost dying thousands of times. And he understood that.
Yeah.
Once you see that, it's a problem. Going back to being a serf.
Yeah.
Going back to being medieval after it's not medieval anymore.
Right.
And that's the attraction for America for all these people. Finnans and other Scottish people here because they're second sons, right? They aren't going to inherit their land. Thompson is here because it's his only way out at all. Jocko Finley's here because his dad was a Scottish fur trader, but his mom is Cree, and he can't do anything. Even in the company he's in, he can only rise to a certain level. So again, you can take that metaphor back to plants really easily, and the way that in the moisture regime we have going on here and the 300 feet of gravel behind the floods, you're only going to be able to do so much if you're a plant. You've got to learn to flourish within those restrictions. Well, plants do that better than anything. And Jocko ended up being fine, but he and Thompson argued all the time because they were at the same level. If you look at pay lists, they were at the same level in 1793, and in 1802, Thompson's partner of the Northwest Company, which is more of a profit sharing company, and Jocko's exactly where he was. He's a mixed blood scout with a lot of skills that they always want to have on their crew, but he's not getting paid anymore. Yeah, it's tough. It's really, there's a lot of anger that's built up in that.
So it seems like, I don't know, I feel like this conversation has changed my perception of what... I think we hear, native plant or introduced plant, but I feel like this conversation is changing my conception of what that means.
It's my conception has changed a lot over time. I don't complain about weeds as much as I used to. I went just like everybody else that lives out. I spent a few years pulling up knapweed in person and all that. Those kinds of things are going. There's always going to be another introduced plant that comes in. I spend my time looking for the native plants with these lists or with a name that a tribal person has. Like, for instance, David Douglas tries to, he understands language. His first language is Welsh, Scottish Gaelic. Thompson's first language is Welsh Gaelic. The sounds in those languages are a lot closer to the sounds in Salish than English is. So if you compare... If you compare, Thompson has some words you can compare to Lewis and Clark words for the same Chinook jargon, stuff like that. You can see that he's hearing them much more clearly than Lewis and Clark are because they're American English speakers versus a Welsh Gaelic first language speaker who can hear glottal stops and pharyngeal, things like that. So it's, again, language is important. And when Douglas writes down, you know, they gave me these bouquet, people gave me this root, but they call Misawi. And he writes it down, and it's exactly the way it is in the Spokane Dictionary from these old school elders that I met in 1970. Misawi, he spells it just the same. And now, you know, they have all these marks and everything they put on different on foreign languages like Salish. And so it doesn't look the same now. But when Douglas wrote it down, it looks just the same. That's me thinking, yeah, you know, he's doing it plant by plant. This is a native cultural plant. His putting it in that, his telling the people in London that, gives it a certain weight. That, like I said, it's his collection sheet for that plant. It has a weight that makes it an important plant. Even in Kew, that's 10 million plants or whatever they have. It's still, that Misawi is still an important plant. And they are now coming around to recognizing that. Because, again, just like they want to have their boat and their language, they want to have their diet back. The reason everybody's so messed up is because you've changed our diet and we're eating hamburgers and potato chips and fried bread when we could be eating things that keep us healthy. That's totally standard, again, all over the world. But with the Kalispell and Salish people, you don't have to go far from Lake Pend'Oreille to get every single thing you need. You make these trips out to the dry country to get the biscuit roots, and then you go up to get your bitter root and your camas, and then you get your berries on a clock that you can just travel around, and that brings you into the red meat that you need for the year, and then fish come. It's just it's so logical, and Thompson figures that out. I mean, his people are buffalo 100% meat diet people that hate berries and vegetables and all that stuff. Never would do it if they. The French Canadians are complaining all the time. But, you know, where's our red meat? And the tribes bring them these baskets of roots and berries, and they might bring them one deer for 15 people a week. You know, it's not what they want, but it's what they're the ones that have to adapt. Thompson is very adaptable guy. He's very flexible.
So this is interesting. I feel like this dynamic was still happening in the 1860s when they were doing the railroad surveys.
For sure.
Some of the maps and things I've read about that period, they look at this region and they aren't even really paying any attention to it. It says inhospitable area, unexplored
region.
Mostly south of here.
But the guys, okay. They were great naturalists on both the British and the American side for the boundary survey. Yeah. And some of them were great linguists and write down language. They collected plants. They have some bird specimens in the Smithsonian that are just really strange. The one I'm talking about right now with the Kalispell. So Thompson comes up here and shoots pigeons, right? The pigeons. So surely he means mourning dove, which I grew up, you know, shooting in the south. But they aren't a lot of food, and Thompson's hungry all the time. But one of the boundaries persons came here, who was a physician, but he was into birds, and shot a passenger pigeon at Lake Pend'Oreille. So think of being in Sandpoint and seeing a passenger pigeon, and you start going, oh my goodness. And we know there's zillions of them back east, and their numbers are just starting to decline in 1860 from over hunting, or wanton slaughter, depending on how you want to say it. And you start thinking, okay, now, did they have a population explosion because of white agriculture in the south, or were they so abundant before? We don't know.
Okay.
We figured, I don't think they were quite so abundant. But they were this really common bird that had a really strong flyer that came all the way out here regularly. And there's another boundary survey guy who splintered at Fort Colville twice and marks the date the passenger pigeons comes back and watch them breed and everything. And at first everybody thought he was wrong, but then it turns out there's a specimen in the Smithsonian that proves that. So again, these markers that we put down where we're changing everything, it's more than that. It's really more than that. And passenger pigeons are now replaced by these Eurasian collared doves that have come back that are the common dove that you hear now in town kind of thing. Well, that's just the next one. Rock doves, that's just the next one. They're going to always be another one. But that's the way to think about plants, too. There's always another related cognate from Asia, from Europe. Or there's all these ones with circumboreal ranges that change when you move them around, that get aggressive. So there's great examples of that, both here and in Europe, that Douglas is directly connected to. So, you know, again, we can mess with this as long as you want, because it never ends. It just never ends.
Yeah. I think one thing that I admire so much about your work is when I'm working at the Bonner County History Museum, I'm kind of looking at this very limited scope of archives that we have right. that are limited to Bonner County, but especially at this period in time, these stories stretch over yeah, so much physical space.
It makes a very narrow
space.
Window, and you want to expand that window. That's what you're always trying to do, is expand that window. Well, the plant specimens expand that window.
Yeah.
And you can get something that Douglas collected as a cultural plant that they're eating, and then you can say, oh, well, when they dug at Sand Creek, when they're putting the bypass in, mm-hmm. there were lots of Chinese doctors along, and they're using all these medicines, and burdock is one of them, and so there's mm-hmm. burdock down by the trout hatchery. Where, mm-hmm. you mean that's an artifact of the Chinese population in Sandpoint from 1880? Mm-hmm. And that's true of many of the Asian cultural plants that came over. Mm-hmm. But then you can go further and say, well, here's an archaeological dig from 200 years ago or 4,600 years ago that has where the netting, well, like at Kettle Falls, there's an unbelievable archaeological work from 9,200 years ago mm-hmm. before the salmon had really reestablished themselves well in the river. Because, of course, the flood wipes them, too. For sure the flood wipes them.
Wait.
It doesn't wipe the people, but any fish in the river is gone. Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. They got to find their way all the way back. And they have people living there who are not fish people. They eat some fish, but there's not abundant fish. Mm. So they're eating birds, and they're eating hazelnuts, which still grow around there abundantly. That's a plant you could trace the whole thing on, because Douglas sees the same deal. And they're eating what some people call wild hyacinths, brodia. It's a beautiful lily that has netting around their corm. And the netting persists. And they have these archaeological digs that have all these piles of netting in the middens, and you can identify the netting really easily. Uh-huh. It's pretty strange. But that expands the story where you can go, like we do a lot of walks around the fish hatchery, mm-hmm. and there's brodia there. Well, that's 10,000 years right there. That's a 10,000-year story instead of an 80-year story mm-hmm. or a 120-year story. Because when Lieberg's here, Sandpoint isn't even here.
Yeah.
When Lieberg's here, Sandpoint is just, it's not even a town to go get your stuff in.
He was at Buttonhook Bay area, right?
He was right at the bottom where Farragut Park is.
Okay.
So Farragut Park, yeah. part of his homestead, you can go see his homestead, and there's a postcard with the kid's cabin on it and mm-hmm. stuff. And you can get his site, and you can line up the, so Bernard Peake, mm-hmm. his son's name Bernard.
Oh, okay.
His middle name is John Bernard. So that's mm-hmm. his son, named after his son. So, yeah, that's his spot. And for him to go get something, he'd have to go to, he'd get in a boat and row over to the mining camp, right, at the Gold Creek,
uh-huh. mm-hmm.
or go to Hope, where yeah. which was the railroad section head, mm-hmm. where his wife was the surgeon.
Okay.
So it's, uh-huh. again, you can't believe that so much has happened to change and rearrange things in 100, we're really talking mm-hmm. about 120 years now. We're talking about 140 years now. Time mm-hmm. passes really quick,
yeah.
but you go from 140 mm-hmm. to 1400 to 14,000.
Right.
That's the sort of the, mm-hmm. how to think about it, I think. And I agree, mm-hmm. your job is hard because all your stuff is in this pack in this window. Mm-hmm. And that's what I'm trying to do, is expand the window mm-hmm. a little bit somehow.
Yeah, because I think it's so easy to presume that, you know, we can see the change and developments that have happened within our lifespan, but I think so many people tend to assume that when you look 100, 500, thousands of years back, like, oh, everything was kind of generally the same. But
right.
that can't be the
no,
case.
No, everything is dynamically bizarre
yeah.
all the time. And that's that's going to be a lesson for global warming when all the fourth graders that I ever see are going, yeah, we're screwed, or all the high school kids, especially mm-hmm. college kids. There's no way that we're going to survive this. Mm-hmm. But we're going to survive it. It might be wildly altered, but mm-hmm. there's, but Rodeo will be here.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the
yeah.
probably the Eurasian collared dove will be here, but a lot of the birds that Douglas saw, ravens will certainly be here.
Mm-hmm.
No question.
Yeah.
But whether we're in the shape that we're in now, it's, mm-hmm. you know, we keep thinking, oh, it's going to change drastically. Well, you don't know that. You cannot predict it. And that's one of the real lessons that Thompson's trying to wrestle with as he goes. Like, he sees all this country. He makes that trip from Missoula to Flathead Lake, back to Ponderay, to Cusick, to the border, back mm-hmm. to Ponderay. You know, he's keep coming back there because that's the way to get up. And he just says, I don't know whether the crown's going to own all this or not, because it's sort of politically, it's hard to tell, but whoever lives here is going to be a very comfortable place to live. If you go over to Plains, the winters are pretty mild. There's good, you know, it's open grasslands. There's sagebrush hills still running around hot springs, you know, on the way up. All these things that we see as little micro habitats, it's nice. The more variation there is, the more you can say, oh, well, let's go get a sage grouse. If the Sharpies aren't down now, we'll go over there and get a sage grouse for supper, kind of thing. And to have Ponderay in the middle of that, I just can't emphasize. So I've worked on this for a long time. The place I work in is like Edmonton to Boise to Southern Oregon to Vancouver Island. But Lake Ponderay's right in the middle of all that, and I keep coming back. And when I was really going crazy about, overly obsessed with Thompson, that's where I kept coming to. And I spent a lot of time on the road to Cusick, because I worked in Cusick and Kalispell Lake a lot, and worked with that tribe a lot. But I also, the wife that I eventually married lived in Missoula, so I would take the highway that goes to Dixon, and go to the Flathead Roads and go down to Missoula that way, because that's the way Thompson went. I was just trying to retrace his trails over and over again during the times of year when he did it.
Yeah.
And that's how I learned a lot of the, that's how a lot of it became to seem familiar. He was doing it for 5 years, and he got very comfortable to do it. But he would see some 80-year-old guy in Cusick, and the guy would say, yeah, let's meet in Plains, right? And Thompson would go there as fast as he could, and this guy and his family with kids and all these people would be there waiting for him, because they knew how to effectively move through the country. And it, at the time, it's all canoes.
Okay, Jack. We've talked a lot about everything and pretty much touched on all these subjects. The thing, as I was kind of thinking about the picture that I kind of came into this conversation with, has already drastically changed, just as Hannah's was. And I was thinking, that probably what I was trying to do was tell an almost biblical story about, first there was the flood, and then came the plants, and then came the people. But it sounds like, of the genesis of our area, kind of. But what I'm hearing here is that that's not at all the right way to look at it. That especially the plant life that kind of came in was always, in some way, being not exactly agriculturally, but was in some way being managed and impacted by the people who were here pretty much from as far back as we can possibly know and understand, right? It's not like people arrived to a landscape that had developed on its own after the floods, but rather the people and the plants came up together after the floods, sort of, or were here and developing together after the floods. Do I have that about right, or how would you tell that story?
Okay. The way I would tell that story is through the Pleistocene, which is hundreds of thousands of years long. And the way that they're telling the flood story is it's always getting more and more layered. And so instead of saying, well, and this is a subject of huge controversy among geologists, the way they like to tell it was that at this date that keeps changing, there were these floods that started, and they don't know how many, and one of them was the last one, and that's sort of what we're seeing. The way they're going to tell it going forward, I'm pretty sure, given the people that I talked to recently, is that the Pleistocene lasted a long time, and the world got cold, and there was ice, and it came and went, and there's four major periods of ice. And in the, there might, so 100,000 years ago, there was an ice event that might have made these ridges that you see when you're coming down past Athol down into Coeur d'Alene on 95, okay? And it's going to get more complex, and the more you try to simplify the more it's going to get complex. And so the way that I'd like to think about it, there's two ways. One is I've spent a lot of time talking to British people on this, and they have quite a different perspective than we do. And there's a guy named Oliver Rackham who is in Britain. They're so cool that they called him a historical botanist, I think, or something like that. And he did a lot of archaeology and pollen counts, and but also talked to a lot of people. And he just he spent his whole career in Britain, just it, the way he described it was just exploding old wives' tales about Sherwood Forest was this primordial forest of oak trees that Robin Hood lived in. He called them, you know, washerwoman stories kind of thing. And but it's the same thing I'm saying, that there was ice over Great Britain, and then it receded, and ever since then, it's a managed landscape. And trees are coming from the continent, coming over, and that there's trees that they say are native trees there, and they're not. That they, you can say that they came over in medieval times or 2,000 years ago. That's still a thing. So it, it explodes this idea of weeds, for one thing. It makes it gives plants more credibility. To weed is a degenerating term, and they aren't. There's much more to knapweed than we think there is. And Oliver was fantastic to talk to, and I begged him to come over here for years. He's passed away, but I begged him for years to come over, because when he first got in touch with me, he had read the David Thompson book, and there's a thing in there about Kootenai people telling him about these animals that are so big that they sleep and don't have any knees, and they sleep by leaning against trees. And to me, that sounds like mammoths, and I just mentioned that. And then Thompson later comes across some big tracks that he thought were mammoths, because Thomas Jefferson thought about had a lot about mammoths, and he found mammoth bones, and he thought they were still alive out here, et cetera. So mammoths is a whole thing. So Oliver contacted me and said, you know, this is weird. Where did you read that thing about Thompson? Because I teach at Cambridge, and there's a book here from like 1200, one of the oldest books they have, this like a bestial, illustrated bestial book about animals, and it has these things from Africa, and it says, these things from Africa that we call elephants, they don't have any knees, and they're so big that they have to sleep by leaning against trees. Wow. I think Thompson stole that. And I'm looking at Thompson, I'm saying, no, Oliver, it's in his journal, his day, I have his day journal. He just wrote it down. He said that he was sitting around with some Kootenai elders, and that's what they told him. Mammoths were in the Pleistocene, starting and evolving 2 million years ago into what we call the Columbia mammoth, which the type specimen is from Hangman Creek right outside the window. And they survived all this coming and going of cold and hot and all the thermal. And say, they survived all that. They survived the floods. There's mammoths here after the floods. So to make, again, you can make the floods a marker, but it's not as much of a marker as we make it.
Yeah.
Again, and because we all grew up with these biblical stories, we want to put them down. That's no stories work that way. And the great thing about tribal stories, they never work that way. They're always very open ended. And there's a great Spokane story about these people living around a lake, and one day the lake drains out, and then the ice age. What a geologist interprets the ice age flood coming. What they're learning now is that the Okanagan lobe had caused Glacial Lake Columbia to cover up all the area here. And there was a lake here. And it did drain out. So there's this movement back and forth, the ice lobes, along with everything else, that's going to really change what Sandpoint looks like and what Spokane looks like. Really alter it. Sandpoint might be under 800 feet of ice, 1,000 feet of ice. But then it might be open. And Spokane might be under a lake. You can't definitely say anything. And again, this is driving geologists crazy, because they've been going around selling this Ice Age flood story. And it's true, there were these Ice Age floods. But you just, it's just so much more complex. And the complexity, or the, you know, that's what writers love. There's things you can't figure out. I've got it made.
This is 88.5 KRFY, Ponderay. You're listening to the Community Character Hour, and we are at an hour plus now, so this is the Community Character Hour and then some. We talked for I have another hour of audio of our conversation with Jack Nesbitt, but we're not going to play it right now. Hannah Combs, Executive Director of the Bonner County Historical Society and Museum, your final thoughts, and then I guess anything else coming up at the museum that you want to put out on the airwaves?
Yeah, I think just I'm hoping that everyone listening is left with the same number of ever expanding questions that I have after talking with Jack Nisbett, which we're hoping to jump into in future episodes. I think we're going to spend some time still exploring this period of time with in the early years for the next at least couple of episodes. So I'm excited to do that. Coming up at the museum this Saturday, March 1st, we have free first Saturday from 10 to 2 at the museum in Lakeview Park at 611 South Ella Avenue with the big yellow caboose out front. Thanks to our sponsor, Diane Brockway, admissions are free for everyone this coming Saturday. We also will have hands-on history activities provided by our education team for kids. So come out, do some kids' activities, explore the museum, and we'll have a good time.
Cool. Yeah, we're past our deadline right now, so I think we'll just wrap it up there. But it was great to talk to Jack. You can find him online. His name is Jack Nisbett. He's one of the main authorities on David Thompson and then and plant life in our area and another number of other subjects. So worth tracking down his work. And we're going to continue on with our regularly scheduled programming. It's time now for Bird Note. Thank you, Hannah.
Thank you.
We'll be talking
Happy
next.
To be here.
Yeah, we'll be back next month. And with that, here we go.
This is Bird Note. Upland sandpipers cut a